Good afternoon, Your Honors. Michael Axelrad of the Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Division of Motor Vehicles, registration number 24460. And before I start my argument, I do have a housekeeping matter that I want to bring to the court's attention. I was working from one PDF file that had all of the record in it, and somehow I inserted a couple of blank pages, and so some of the references to the record, the page number was off slightly by a couple of pages, and this was primarily with the district court's order, so I wanted the court to be aware of that, and I wanted to extend my apologies for any confusion that that may have caused.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Yeah. And may it please the court, we are here today because the district court in this matter applied an incorrect standard of review and substituted its judgment regarding the weight of the evidence for that of the hearing officer in reversing the division's order of replication. There are a few simple principles of law, and I think these are well established, and they will in total support the position that we're taking. The first one, of course, is that strict compliance with the public health rules and regulations is not required. And the second one has to do with the fact that in administrative law, it is up to the hearing officer to decide from the evidence that is presented whether it can determine, first, that the test was conducted in substantial compliance with regulations, and second, that the driver's blood alcohol exceeded the statutory limit. By statute, and this is the third principle, the hearing officer may consider all of the items that are listed in 42.2.126 subsection 8, which could include hearsay. It also allows the hearing officer to take judicial notice of general, technical, or scientific facts within the hearing officer's knowledge. And the fourth principle that ties these together is that it is the hearing officer's province to decide upon this evidence, the sufficiency, the probative effect, and the weight of the evidence, and to assess the credibility of the witnesses. Of course, that last item is not an issue in this case, but sufficiency, probative effect, and weight of evidence. And the other point that goes with that is that these findings will not be overturned on appeal unless the findings are so clearly erroneous as to find no support in the record. In this case, there is no dispute before the court about whether the stop was proper or whether the driver failed the roadside sobriety test. The sole issue is that the evidence packet that was presented to the hearing officer was notable for its paucity, and I think the hearing officer used that word. Certain things that he expected to see in the packet were not there, specifically the checklist that is required by the regulations.
Operational checklist.
Yes, thank you. The operational checklist.
Is that part of the regulatory requirements that it be there?
It's not a requirement that it be there. In fact, there have been a number of cases from the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court that talk about substantial compliance rather than strict compliance with the regulations. And in other cases, there have been situations where the court has talked about what is required in the regulations and has noted that the General Assembly did not require that these be strictly complied with. Some of the leading cases, Colorado Department of Revenue versus McBroom, Supreme Court case 753 Pacific 2nd at 239, stated the controlling statute does not specifically require that a testing officer's certification be proven in order to establish a prima facie case or permit the entry of blood test results as evidence. The checklist by itself is somewhat duplicative of other evidence that's in the record. Specifically, the printout from the breathalyzer as the court noted in this case, it contains sufficient evidence by itself. First, it has the certification of the machine, the date of the certification. Second, the certification of the officer using it.
Certification of the actual machine that was used in this case? Do we have that on file?
There was a certificate from another machine. However, the printout, the one-page printout from the breathalyzer itself, was from the actual machine, of course, because that's the one that on which the test was performed. And that had a data certification on it. The third thing is it has the signature of the officer attesting that the procedures were done in conformance with the regulations.
That's right. I'm confused. What was certified about the machine that was actually used, and what was certified about a different machine?
In the record, there was a certificate that I suppose is generally issued for all these machines. I really don't know, but it's a form of a certificate. It looks like a certificate with a border. This one had a serial number that was different from the machine that was actually used in this case. And we know that because the serial number on that printed certificate was different from the serial number on the printout from the breathalyzer itself.
You're not suggesting that certificate for a different machine is in any way helpful to your case, are you?
Not at all. I'm saying that document, that one-page document, is a nullity in this case. It has nothing to do with the machine at issue. However, the printout from the breathalyzer itself does contain the certification number. And clearly, because this is the piece of paper that was printed out from the machine, it was signed by the officer. This is the machine that on which the test was performed. And the certification date was within the legal time frame. The certification of the officer was within that legal time frame. This document by itself, with the certification of the officer that the test was performed in conformance with the rules and regulations, supplies the evidence on which the court could, on which the hearing officer could reach its conclusion that the test had been performed in conformance with the regulations.
And counsel, my understanding is there was a third missing item, a document showing compliance with the 20-minute observation rule. Do you agree with that?
Thank you, Your Honor. And yes, I was going to get to that as well. The hearing officer noted from other documents in the record, the arresting officer's report, which indicated the time of the stop, the printout, again, from the machine that indicated the time when the test was performed, indicated more than 20 minutes. Now, as the hearing officer noted in his findings, the purpose of that 20-minute period is to assure that there is no breath alcohol, mouth alcohol, that could contaminate the test. The hearing officer also noted from his experience in this that if there had been mouth alcohol present, there are fail-safes in the system that it would not be able to print out a result of the test. And he determined that because there was a printout, that this contamination had not occurred.
So by allowing the hearing officer to rely on his experience, then does the statute allow a broader range of evidence than, say, judicial notice would?
I don't believe that it's broader than judicial notice. With his experience with the way that these machines work, it's something that he's allowed to take notice of, general technical or scientific facts within the hearing officer's knowledge. That's the statutory, one of the two statutory classes of judicial notice. And in this case, we believe that that was within his experience and within his knowledge, so therefore proper for judicial notice. We also note that that was not challenged on appeal with any authority. Now, Mr. Davis contends that you need the solution log in order for this, but we do not have a citation to that, no authority for that statement. It's merely an argument without authority, and so therefore we believe that the hearing officer's right to rely on judicial notice of this has not been challenged on this appeal. We have this record then, the certification, which indicates that the blood alcohol was 0.085, certification from the officer that it was done in conformance with the regulations, the as a failed safe measure, as a stopgap evidentiary measure, the judicial notice that the machine could not have printed out a result if there was mouth alcohol. And there are two separate tests for that. There's, I believe it's called slope variant, which would indicate a sharp distinction in the level of alcohol across a short period of time. The machine would not give a printout. And second, if there was more than a 0.02 difference between the two blows, it would not print out a result. And those are the two fail-safes against mouth alcohol.
Axelrod, is that something, I'm confused as, again, is that something that the officer, the police officer testified to at the hearing, or is that something that the hearing officer took judicial notice of?
The hearing officer took judicial notice.
How can you take judicial notice of how a breath alcohol machine works? I thought the test for judicial notice is something that everybody knows and understands and couldn't possibly disagree with, like the sun rising in the east. And personally, I don't know how a breath alcohol test machine works. So how could that possibly be the subject of judicial notice?
The statute's standard of general technical or scientific facts within the hearing officer's knowledge. This is different than the rules of evidence that have that requirement of general knowledge. In this case, breaking down that phrase, it's general, technical, or scientific facts. If this is something within the hearing officer's knowledge, even if it's not general.
So I guess it goes back to my earlier question that you said it was commensurate with judicial notice. Now you're saying that the statute allows for broader recognition of evidence than the general concept of judicial notice.
I'm saying that the judicial notice that's allowed by this statute, 42-126, is broader than the Colorado rules of evidence.
Okay, that's kind of what I was maybe not asking very clearly before, but you've clarified, okay. So thank you.
All right. That's our position on the evidence that was allowed in. I notice my time is running short, and I do want to emphasize the standard of review. And the primary case that we relied on is Bunger versus Heckers, 528 Pacific 2nd, 422, a Colorado appellate court case, in which the court held that in order to, that, let me restate that, it's within the hearing officer's province to determine the sufficiency, probative effect, and weight of the evidence, and to assess the credibility of witnesses. Its findings will not be overturned on appeal unless the findings are so clearly erroneous as not to find support in the record. There is support in the record.
So I have a question about judicial review as well that I've been sort of jotting down as you've been talking. In listening to your presentation, my question is, what judicial review do the courts have if the hearing officer can decide the weight on everything regardless of regulatory requirement compliance? We talked about the three items that were not complied with. What is our judicial review? And then you added some hearing office, that the hearing officer could take judicial notice of different things.
It's a highly discretionary standard, Your Honor. The hearing officer is presented with the evidence at the hearing. And the standard has always been that it's just even mere scintilla of evidence and support is going to be sufficient. In our briefs, we quoted the Black Diamond Fund case, which talks about the quantum of probative evidence that needs to be shown in order to uphold the hearing officer's determination. And it's that amount of evidence that a fact finder would accept as adequate to support a conclusion without regard to the existence of conflicting evidence. So therefore, if there is evidence in the record which is sufficient for the hearing officer to reach a conclusion on by a preponderance of the evidence, then even if there is conflicting evidence, we defer to the decisions that were made by the hearing officer with regard to whether that's sufficient to establish the point of law that supports the conclusion reached by the hearing officer. It's highly deferential, and yes, there are, it can always be tested by a factual review if the hearing officer makes a conclusion or reaches a conclusion that is contrary to fact, and it can be shown that, then yes, that judicial notice may be withdrawn, and it may not be proper in that case. But we don't have any challenge in this case to the hearing officer's conclusions. I see my time is wrapping up. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Another question along the housekeeping lines that you had mentioned earlier. I noticed that the hearing officer is a named party in this case. Is that standard in these cases? Or? Why?
That's an interesting question, and I'm not sure that I can answer it. Division of Motor Vehicles is generally the party that is named. Hearing officer, I do see it from time to time. Frankly, since I treat them as having the same interest in this case, I did not focus on that issue, and I know that he was named in there because he was named in the appeal at the district court. Thank you.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Jessica Schmidt. I'm with Ridley McGreevy and Winokur. I'm here representing Tyson Davis, the appellee in this matter. My attorney registration number is 37928.
Another housekeeping matter. Have you entered an appearance yet?
I have. We submitted a written entry of appearance.
Very good.
Thank you. Your Honor, I would like to start with the issue that we ended with, which was detailing the standard of review that should be applied to this case. I think within the analysis of both the standard of review and then the factual determinations that were also discussed, there's one overlying conclusion that the district court made that I think this court should ultimately find is persuasive and the basis for which the court should affirm the district court's ruling, and that is that substantial compliance requires something more than just the printout of the one test result. And the way that this factors into the standard of review is that we're here arguing that this should be reviewed under a de novo review, where there is a question of law that is actually involved. And we would turn the court's attention to the statute that involves the reviewing of these agency decisions, cited in the briefs as well, which is the 42-2-126. And then the case law as well, which is cited, that speaks to administrative decisions being reviewed if matters of law, de novo, and if there are factual issues, certainly there's questions of whether or not there was an erroneous interpretation of the law, or if the court acted the DMV officer acted arbitrarily and capriciously.
Schmidt, it seems like at bottom your argument is really one of insufficient evidence. Is that correct?
The insufficiency of the evidence would be part of the argument, but initially we would be arguing that it's a question of law and that the improper legal standard was reviewed by the hearing officer when making that determination and ultimately applying those facts to that legal determination. And so I would argue to the court that, yes, ultimately it becomes a sufficiency of the evidence question.
But wouldn't that be a mixed question of fact and law, because we obviously have to look at the facts that were presented to the hearing officer and then determine as a matter of law whether that was sufficient to establish interpretation.
And I think the court can look at it as a mixed question of fact and law, where initially the question is, should the hearing officer have just determined, is the Department of Health regulations, have they been complied with? And then, is then the test reliable? And I think that, or what we would be arguing is that that is not sufficient. What had to be done was, certainly, this is not a strict compliance case. We're not arguing that. I know that that was alluded to in the briefs. We recognize that the standard is substantial compliance. But within that, the substantial compliance goes to actually being substantially compliant with the Department of Health and Regulations. And the Department of Health and Regulations set forth these mandatory provisions as to what is required to be shown for these breath tests in this circumstance to be considered both reliable and valid and be able to be used by the hearing officers to then support a revocation of a license.
I'm going to continue in being confused. I thought Mr. Axelrod said that the operational checklist was not required by the regulations.
And I did want to clarify that. I would contest that and argue that the checklist, which is included in Appendix 2A, is required. That 4.3.1.2 says the certified EBAT operator instructor must document compliance with these testing procedures by completion of the department's checklist form. It then goes on in the definitions of terms at 1.5, and when it defines the DUI packet that's submitted, it says it must include an error-free EBAT, so the breath result, proof of certification for that instrument, which we also don't have here in the certification document, as well as all Appendix 2A checklists, which are initialed. The reason those things are so important is because they go towards the reliability and the validity of the test results. And the Department of Regulations, the health regulations, state that when these things are complied with, when these requirements we set forth with the mandatory language must be complied with, that's when we can presume the validity of these tests.
So let me kind of flesh out your position, Ms. Schmidt, if I might. So if the department or the Division of Motor Vehicles doesn't present an operational checklist in any case, does that mean that it will always or should always lose?
The operational checklist, we would argue, is very important, but the question is the substantial compliance. And if there were other ways for them to show that those things within the checklist have been complied with, if, for instance, someone had testified, an officer, and said, I did these things, I mistakenly didn't include this in the packet, I think that's a different question. And it's possible for a court or the hearing officer to determine, despite this incomplete submission, despite not having the checklist here, we still can find that this is substantial compliance because all the things that were included in the checklist have still been shown to have been done.
For example, if the printout has a certificate number, you don't have the actual certificate because you have one for a different machine, but the printout does include a number. Isn't that some evidence?
And I understand what the court is stating, but the one piece of evidence that they did receive did have the appropriate intoxilizer and it did have a certification date. That, I think, is evidence towards that. The problem with this case, however, is that that's only one piece of the many pieces of evidence that was missing. So, yes, I think that it's possible to suggest that even though in this case there was not the certificate that specifically says this was certified on this date, and we have the typical submission that's in the DUI packet, but we have this other piece of evidence, the hearing officer may be able to use that as evidence in its totality of its the circumstances it's considering. But here we still don't have enough, because that's not the only thing that was missing. Certification may be something that this court may say, well, there was substantial compliance with the certification. But there has to be more than just the certification of the machine, because when you look to the standards that are put forth in the case law that was discussed in the briefing, to Brewer and to McBroom and to Bowers, what they're saying is, if you comply completely with these regulations, then you have a prima facie case that shows this is likely valid and reliable, and we're going to let this in into evidence. If you comply completely, well, we don't have that here. And so the question becomes, has a prima facie case been established? Because when those cases say, you know, even though there were issues with what had happened, we still find that there was sufficient evidence, they look to three different standards. One is, Was it shown that there was a reliable testing device? Was it conducted by a reliable person who's been certified? And then was the test actually, in the way it was administered, was it reliable? And when you look to the answers to those questions in this case, not only do you not have the presumption of the prima facie case that would come to with compliance from the Department of Health regulations, you can't answer those questions in the affirmative. You can't say, well, the other evidence that we're presented with satisfies those inquiries. Were the testing procedures done reliably? Well, we can't be sure, because there's a checklist that goes through and requires them to check off the 6 things that are done to ensure, as required by the Department of Health, that this is how it's done reliably.
I have a question. In the answer brief, you don't seem to have a problem with the officer taking judicial notice as required by the statute. But then the hearing officer said the intoxilizer won't even permit a test unless it's in proper order. So if he can properly take judicial notice of that, doesn't that cover a great deal of the reliability findings?
And, Your Honor, I would state that we do not, in that reply brief, well, we don't use the words that we object to the judicial notice abilities of the officer. It is our position that we have stated that he made inferences that were beyond his abilities as the hearing officer. And even though the judicial notice statute requires him to take notice of technical information within his knowledge, this goes beyond that. This is an inference beyond just technical information, and so this wouldn't be covered by the judicial notice. And the reason is this. He's saying he's inferring from the printout that because it generates a response, because it shows the test results, then we can be sure that there wasn't sort of regurgitation that would have showed up as a void, or that there wasn't a problem where there was this a difference in the readings that was so concerning. And the reason we know that is because otherwise it would have shown up on the one page that I do have. The problem is that is requiring that piece of paper to self-certify that machine. And so it's saying, we're assuming that this is a properly functioning machine, because a properly functioning machine would work this way. And under the guidelines for the Department of Health, that's inappropriate in this case. Because it was argued in the DMV hearing, we can't be sure that machine is working properly, because another thing that is submitted with that printout is a simulator solution log, which was also absent here. And that shows previous tests that have been done by that one machine, so that we can review and say, are the results we're getting from this, are they appropriate? Is the machine functioning as it should be? And not look just to when the machine does function, is it saying it's functioning? Because it could very well say it's functioning and be malfunctioning, which is why we have it being certified and being tested and showing a track record of being the appropriate result.
Is there anything in the record that explains why nobody testified and why more evidence wasn't presented on behalf of the Motor Vehicle Division?
There was nothing in the record with regard to that. What I can tell the court is that there wasn't any testimony. And because it's the burden is on the hearing officer, or at least to show the revocation, they have to find beyond a preponderance of the evidence. It has to be information that's just found within the record as presented that day. And so there can't be these sort of assumptions that things were done correctly without there being the evidence within the record itself, which becomes a really big problem with regard to the 20-minute waiting period. And I know that was something that the court had addressed initially, and that's something that would be included in that checklist. And that checklist shows that, yes, I waited the 20 minutes, and then a police officer would sign his name and check that in one of the 6 check boxes. And without...
Here, didn't the hearing officer infer that the 20 minutes had elapsed, so that even though there was no testimony, that he could reach that conclusion that it had been satisfied?
The hearing officer did infer that, and what? We would object to that being a proper basis for inference, because that was something that was not included within the record, and that's not something that is general technical knowledge that the hearing officer has and can have in his own in the work that he's doing, because the police officer very well could not have been present during the 20-minute period. And there's question even in the record whether or not there was sufficient time for there to have been 20 minutes elapsing between the time of the actual arrest and the time of the test itself. There was a mere half hour. And so there was transport that had to be done. There was arresting, the handcuffing. Who can be sure what happened during that time? And that's the point. The problem is that you can't take judicial notice of things that would be factual representations that need to be included in the record. Because a number of things could have happened. Maybe that officer was pulled away to help with the booking of another person who was coming into the station at that time and couldn't watch the person. And the way that we are sure that substantial compliance with those mandatory regulations has actually occurred is when they have the checklist. And because that checklist isn't there, that problem can't be answered with regard to if the test was conducted properly. The concern about whether or not this machine was certified and whether or not the machine itself was properly used and reliable comes into effect with the questions we had previously with regard to the simulator solution log and not seeing a track record and not allowing for that specific machine to certify itself. And so when you don't have that other analysis that you can go through, where you can't go through and look at information and determine, you know, based on the record we have here, those things can be shown, there cannot be a statement that this was substantial compliance with those regulations, such that we have a prima facie case, and then the little problems that may have occurred, for instance, is the hearing officer even referred to a couple of times. Well, maybe one check may not have been included, or maybe there was a missing signature and we think of it as a Scribner's error. Those things can be excused, and that can go to weight or not admissibility when you have this prima facie case. But as the district court stated when it reviewed the hearing officer's order, the prima facie case was never established. And so the prima facie case and what's needed to show substantial compliance is this question of law. And then it's either clearly erroneous, or which is the administrative law standards, or arbitrary and capricious under the 42.2.126.
So was the district court wrong when it said that substantial compliance was a question of fact?
The substantial compliance with regard to the ultimate questions, I think, is a question of fact, as far as like, what are there enough facts to apply to this legal reasoning that the hearing officer didn't go to? And so I think that the mixed question of law and fact is appropriate. And I see that my time is up, unless there are further questions.
Yes, thank you very much. Thanks, Mr. Rad. We appreciate both of your arguments this afternoon, as well as your willingness to come a little bit early. That concludes the arguments this afternoon. Division one, written opinion will be issued in due course in this case.